Parwana thought then of the notebook hidden under a pile of her things at home. Sabu was always coming up with stories, tales packed with djinns and fairies and demons and deeps. Often village kids gathered around him and listened in absolute quiet as he made up fables for them. And about 6 months earlier, Parwana had overheard Sabur telling Nabi that one day he hoped to write his stories down. It was shortly after that that Parwana, with her mother, had found herself at a bazaar in another town. And there, at a stall that sold used books, she had spotted a beautiful notebook with crisp lined pages and a thick dark brown leather binding embossed along the edges. Holding it in her hand, she knew her mother couldn't afford to buy it for her. So Parwana had picked a moment when the shopkeeper was not looking and quickly slipped the notebook under her sweater. But in the 6 months that had since passed, Parwana still hadn't found the courage to give the notebook to Sabur. She was terrified that he might laugh or that he would see it for what it was and give it back. Instead, every night she lay in her cot, the notebook secretly clutched in her hands under the blanket, fingertips brushing the engravings on the leather. "Tomorrow," she promised herself every night, "tomorrow I will walk up to him with it." Later that evening, after iftar dinner, all the kids rushed outside to play. Parwana, Masum, and Sabur took turns on the swing that Sabur's father had suspended from a sturdy branch of the giant oak tree. Parwana took her turn, but Sabur kept forgetting to push her because he was busy telling another story. This time it was about the giant oak tree, which he said had magic powers. "If you had a wish," he said, "you had to kneel before the tree and whisper it. And if the tree agreed to grant it, it would shed exactly 10 leaves upon your head." When the swing slowed to a near stop, Parwana turned to tell Sabur to keep pushing, but the words died in her throat. Sabur and Masuma were smiling at each other, and in Sabur's hand, Parwana saw the notebook, her notebook. "I found it in the house," Masuma said later. "Was it yours? I'll pay you back for it somehow. I promise. You don't mind, do you? I just thought it was perfect for him, for his stories. Did you see the look on him? Did you, Parwana?" Parwana said no. She didn't mind. But inside, she was crumpling. Over and over, she pictured how her sister and Sabur had smiled at each other, the look they shared between them. Parwana might as well have winked out into thin air like a genie from one of Sabur's stories. So unaware they had been of her presence, it cut her to the bone. That night, on her cot, she cried very quietly. By the time she and her sister were 11, Parwana had developed a precocious understanding of the strange behavior of boys around girls they privately liked. She saw this especially as she and Masuma walked home from school. School was really the back room of the village mosque, where, in addition to teaching Quran recitation, Mullah Shakib had taught every child in the village to read and write, to memorize poetry. Shadbagh was fortunate to have such a wise man for a Malik, the girl's father told them. On the way home from these lessons, the twins often came across a group of boys sitting on a wall. As the girls passed, the boys sometimes heckled, sometimes threw pebbles. Parwana usually shouted back and answered the pebbles with rocks, while Masuma always pulled her elbow and told her in a sensible voice to walk faster, to not let them anger her. But she misunderstood. Parwana was angry not because they threw pebbles, but because they threw them only at Masuma. Parwana knew. They made a show of the ribbing, and the bigger the show, the deeper the desire. She noticed the way their eyes ricocheted off her and trained themselves on Masuma, forlorn with wonder, helpless to pull away. She knew that behind their crass jokes and lascivious grins, they were terrified of Masuma. Then, one day, one of them hurled not a pebble, but a rock. It rolled to the sisters' feet. When Massima picked it up, the boys snickered and elbowed one another. An elastic band held the sheet of paper wrapped around the rock. When they were at a safe distance, Massima unrolled it. They both read the note. I swear since seeing your face, the whole world is fraud and fantasy. The garden is bewildered as to what is leaf or blossom. The distracted birds can distinguish the bird seed from the snare. A Rumi poem, one from Mullah Shakib's teachings. They're getting more sophisticated, Massima said with a chuckle. Below the poem, the boy had written, I want to marry you, and below that, he had scribbled his addendum. I've got a cousin for your sister. He's a perfect match. They can graze my uncle's field together. Massima tore the note in half. Don't mind them, Parwana, she said. They're imbeciles. Cretans, Parwana agreed. Such effort it took to plaster a grin on her face. The note was bad enough, but what really stung was Masuma's response. The boy hadn't explicitly addressed his note to either one of them, but Massima had casually assumed that he had intended the poem for her and the cousin for Parwana. For the first time, Parwana saw herself through her sister's eyes. She saw how her sister viewed her, which was the same as how the rest of them did. It left her gutted, what Massima said. It flattened her. Besides, Massima added with a shrug and a grin, I'm already taken. Nabi has come for his monthly visit. He is the family's success story, perhaps the entire village's too, on account of his working in Kabul. He's driving into Shadbagh in his employer's big shiny blue car with the gleaming eagle's head hood ornament. Everyone gathering to watch his arrival, the village kids hollering and running alongside the car. How are things? He asks. The three of them are inside the hut, having tea and almonds. Nabi is very handsome, Parwana thinks, with his fine chiseled cheekbones, his hazel eyes, his sideburns, and a thick wall of black hair swept back from his forehead. He's dressed in his customary olive-colored suit that looks a size or two big on him. Nabi is proud of the suit, Parwana knows, always tugging at the sleeves, straightening the lapel, pinching the crease of his pants, though he has never quite managed to eradicate its lingering whiff of burnt onions. Well, we had Queen Homera over for tea and cookies yesterday, Massima says. She complimented our exquisite choice of decor. She smiles amiably at her brother, revealing her yellowing teeth. And Nabi laughs, looking down at his cup. Before he found work in Kabul, Nabi had helped Parwana care for their sister. Or he had tried for a while, but he couldn't do it. It was too much for him. Kabul was Nabi's escape. Parwana envies her brother, but she does not entirely begrudge him, even if he does. She knows that there is more than an element of penance in the monthly cash that he brings her. Massima has brushed her hair and rimmed her eyes with a dash of kohl, as she always does when Nabi visits. Parwana knows that she does it only partially for his benefit and more for the fact that he is her tie to Kabul. In Masuma's mind, he connects her to glamour and luxury, to a city of cars and lights and fancy restaurants and royal palaces, regardless of how remote this link might be. Parwana remembers how, long ago, Massima used to say to her that she was a city girl trapped in a village. What about you? Have you found yourself a wife yet? Massima asks playfully. Nabi waves a hand and laughs her off, as he used to when their parents ask him the same question. So, when are you going to show me around Kabul again, brother? Massima says. Nabi had taken them to Kabul once the year before. He had picked them up from Shadbagh and driven them to Kabul, up and down the streets of the city. He had shown them all the mosques, the shopping districts, the cinemas, the restaurants. He had pointed out to Massima the domed Baghabala Palace sitting on a hill overlooking the city. At the gardens of Babur, he had lifted Massima from the front seat of the car and carried her in his arms to the side of the Mughal emperor's tomb. They had prayed there, the three of them, at the Shah Jahan Mosque, and then, at the edge of a blue-tiled pool, they had eaten the meal Nabi had packed for them. It had been perhaps the happiest day of Masuma's life since the accident, and for that Parwana was grateful to her older brother. "Soon, inshallah," Nabi says, tapping a finger against the cup. "Would you mind adjusting this cushion under my knees, Nabi?" "Oh, that's much better. Thank you," Masuma sighs. "I loved Kabul. If I could, I'd march all the way there first thing tomorrow." "Maybe one day," Nabi says. "What, me walking?" "No," he stammers. "I meant..." And then he grins when Masuma bursts out laughing. Outside, Nabi passes Parwana the cash. He leans one shoulder against the wall and lights a cigarette. Masuma is inside, taking her afternoon nap. "I saw Sabu earlier," he says, picking at his finger. "Terrible thing. He told me the baby's name. I forget now." "Peri," Parwana says. He nods. "I didn't ask, but he told me he's looking to marry again." Parwana looks away, trying to pretend she doesn't care, but her heart is thumping in her ears. She feels a film of sweat blooming on her skin. "Like I said, I didn't ask. Sabu was the one who brought it up. He pulled me aside. He pulled me aside and told me." Parwana suspects that Nabi knows what she has carried with her for Sabu all these years. Masuma is her twin, but it is Nabi who has always understood her. But Parwana doesn't see why her brother is telling her this news. What good does it do? What Sabu needs is a woman unanchored, a woman who won't be held down, who is free to devote herself to him, to his boy, his newborn daughter. Parwana's time is already consumed, accounted for. Her whole life is. "I'm sure he'll find someone," Parwana says. Nabi nods. "I'll be by again next month." He crushes his cigarette underfoot and takes his leave. When Parwana enters the hut, she is surprised to see Masuma awake. "I thought you were napping." Masuma drags her gaze to the window, blinking slowly, tiredly. When the girls were 13, they sometimes went to the crowded bazaars of nearby towns for their mother. The smell of freshly sprayed water rose from the unpaved street. The two of them strolled down the lanes, past stalls that sold hookahs, silk shawls, copper pots, old watches. Slaughtered chickens hung by their feet, tracing slow circles over hunks of lamb and beef. In every corridor, Parwana would see men's eyes snapping to attention when Masuma passed by. She saw their efforts to behave matter-of-factly, but their gazes lingered, helpless to tear away. If Masuma glanced in their direction, they looked idiotically privileged. They imagined they had shared a moment with her. She interrupted conversations mid-sentence, smokers mid-drag. She was the trembler of knees, the spiller of teacups. Some days it was all too much for Masuma, as if she was almost ashamed, and she told Parwana she wanted to stay inside all day, wanted not to be looked at. On those days, Parwana thought it was as though somewhere deep inside, her sister understood dimly that her beauty was a weapon, a loaded gun, with the barrel pointed at her own head. Most days, however, the attention seemed to please her. Most days, she relished her power to derail men's thoughts with a single fleeting but strategic smile, to make tongues falter over words. It blistered the eyes, beauty like hers. And then there was Parwana, shuffling next to her, with her flat chest and sallow complexion, her fizzy hair, her heavy, mournful face, and her thick wrists and masculine shoulders. A pathetic shadow, torn between her envy and the thrill of being seen with Masuma, sharing in the attention as a weed would, lapping up water meant for the lily upstream. All her life, Parwana had made sure to avoid standing in front of a mirror with her sister. It robbed her of hope to see her face beside Masuma's, to see so plainly what she had been denied. But in public, every stranger's eye was a mirror. There was no escape. She carries Masuma outside. The two of them sit on the charpoy Parwana has set up. She makes sure to stack cushions so Masuma can comfortably lean her back against the wall. The night is quiet but for the chirping crickets, and dark too, lit only by a few lanterns still shimmering in windows, and by the papery white light of the three-quarter moon. Parwana fills the hookah's face with water. She takes two matchhead-sized portions of opium, flakes with a pinch of tobacco, and drops the mix into the hookah's bowl. She lights the coal on the metal screen and hands the hookah to her sister. Masuma takes a deep puff from the hose, reclines against the cushions, and asks if she can rest her legs on Parwana's lap. Parwana reaches down and lifts the limp legs to rest across her own. When she smokes, Masuma's face slackens. Her lids droop. Her head tilts unsteadily to the side, and her voice takes on a sluggish, distant quality. A whisper of a smile forms on the corners of her mouth, whimsical, indolent, complacent rather than content. They say little to each other when Masuma is like this. Parwana listens to the breeze, to the water gurgling in the hookah. She watches the stars and the smoke drifting over her. The silence is pleasant, and neither she nor Masuma feel an urge to fill it with needless words. Until Masuma says, "Will you do something for me?" Parwana looks at her. "I want you to take me to Kabul." Masuma exhales slowly, the smoke twirling, curling, morphing into shapes with each blink of the eye. "Are you serious?" "I want to see Darul Amon Palace. We didn't get a chance to last time. Maybe go visit Babur's tomb again." Parwana leans forward to decipher Masuma's expression. She searches for a hint of playfulness, but in the moonlight she catches only the calm, unblinking glitter of her sister's eyes. "It's a two-day walk, at least, probably three. Imagine Nabi's face when we surprise him at his door. We don't even know where he lives." Masuma listlessly sweeps her hand. "He already told us which neighborhood. We'll knock on some doors and ask. It's not that difficult." "How would we get there, Masuma, in your condition?" Masuma pulls the hookah hose from her lips. "When you were out working today, Mullah Shakib came by, and I spoke to him a long time. I told him we were going to Kabul for a few days, just you and I. He gave me his blessing in the end, also his mule. So you see, it's all arranged." "You are insane," Parwana says. "Well, it's what I want. It's my wish." Parwana sits back against the wall, shaking her head. Her gaze drifts upward into the cloud-muddled darkness. "I'm so bored, I'm dying, Parwana." Parwana empties her chest of a sigh and looks at her sister. Masuma brings the hose to her lips. "Please, don't deny me." One early morning, when the sisters were 17, they sat on a branch high up the oak tree, their feet dangling. "Sabur's going to ask me." Masuma had said this in a high-pitched whisper. "Ask you?" Parwana said, not understanding, at least not immediately. "Well, not him, of course," Masuma laughed into her palm. "Of course not. His father will be doing the asking." Now Parwana understood. Her heart sank to her feet. "How do you know?" she said through numb lips. Masuma began to speak, words pouring from her mouth at a frenzied pace. But Parwana hardly heard any of it. She was picturing instead her sister's wedding to Sabur. Children in new clothes, carrying henna baskets overflowing with flowers, trailed by Shahaneh and the hall players. Sabur, opening Masuma's fist, placing the henna in her palm, tying it with a white ribbon. The saying of prayers, the blessing of the union, the offering of gifts. The two of them gazing at each other beneath a veil, embroidered with gold thread, feeding each other a spoonful of sweet sherbet and malide. And she, Parwana, would be there among the guests to watch this unfold. She would be expected to smile, to clap, to be happy, even as her heart splintered and cracked. A wind swept through the tree, made the branches around them shake and the leaves rattle. Parwana had to steady herself. Masuma had stopped talking. She was grinning, biting her lower lip. "You asked how I know that he's going to ask? I'll tell you. No, I'll show you." She turned from Parwana and reached into her pocket. And then the part that Masuma knew nothing about. While her sister was facing away, searching her pocket, Parwana planted the heels of her hands on the branch, lifted her bottom, and let it drop. The branch shook. Masuma gasped and lost her balance. Her arms flailed wildly. She tipped forward. Parwana watched her own hands move. What they did was not really push, but there was contact between Masuma's back and the pads of Parwana's fingertips, and there was a brief moment of subtle shoving. But it lasted barely an instant before Parwana was reaching for her sister, for the hem of her shirt, before Masuma was calling her name in panic and Parwana hers. Parwana grabbed the shirt, and it looked, just for a moment, as though she might have saved Masuma. But then the cloth ripped as it slipped from her grip. Masuma fell from the tree. It seemed to take forever, the fall. Her torso, slamming into branches on the way down, startling birds and shaking leaves free. Her body spinning, bouncing, snapping smaller branches, until a low, thick branch, the one from which the swing was suspended, caught her lower back with a sick, audible crunch. She folded backward, nearly in half. A few minutes later, a circle had formed around her. Nabi and the girl's father crying over Masuma, trying to shake her awake. Faces peering down. Someone took her hand. It was still closed into a tight fist. When they uncurled the fingers, they found exactly 10 crumbled little leaves in her palm. Masuma says, her voice shaking a bit, "You have to do it. Now. If you wait until morning, you'll lose heart." All around them, beyond the dim glow of the fire, Parwana has stoked from shrubs and brittle-looking weeds, is the desolate, endless expanse of sand and mountains, swallowed up by the dark. For nearly 2 days they have traveled through the scrubby terrain, heading toward Kabul. Parwana walking alongside the mule, Masuma strapped to the saddle, Parwana holding her hand. They have trudged along steep paths that curved and dipped and wound back and forth across rocky ridges. The ground at their feet, dotted with ochre and rust-colored weeds, etched with long, spidery cracks, creeping every which way. Parwana stands near the fire now, looking at Masuma, who is a horizontal blanketed mound on the other side of the flames. "What about Kabul?" Parwana says. "Oh, you're supposed to be the smart one." Parwana says, "You can't ask me to do this. I am tired, Parwana. It's not a life, what I have. My existence is a punishment to us both." "Let's just go back," Parwana says, her throat beginning to close. "I can't do this. I can't let you go." "You're not," Masuma is crying now. "I am letting you go. I am releasing you." Parwana thinks of a long ago night. Masuma up on the swing. She pushing her. She had watched as Masuma had straightened her legs and tipped her head all the way back at the peak of each upward swing. The long trails of her hair flapping like sheets on a clothesline. She remembers all the little dolls they had coaxed out of corn husks together, dressing them in wedding gowns made of shreds of old cloth. Tell me something, sister. Parvana blinks back the tears that are blurring her vision now and wipes her nose with the back of her hand. His boy, Abdullah, and the baby girl, Pari, you think you could love them as your own? Masuma, could you? I could try, Parvana says. Good. Then marry Sabur. Look after his children. Have your own. He loved you. He doesn't love me. He will, given time. This is all my doing, Parvana says. My fault. All of it. I don't know what that means, and I don't want to. At this point, this is the only thing I want. People will understand, Parvana. Mullah Shakib will have told them. He'll tell them that he gave me his blessing for this. Parvana raises her face to the darkened sky. Be happy, Parvana. Please be happy. Do it for me. Parvana feels herself standing on the brink of telling her everything. Telling Masuma how wrong she is. How little she knows the sister with whom she shared the womb. How for years now, Parwana's life has been one long unspoken apology. But to what end? Her own relief once again at Masuma's expense? She bites down the words. She has inflicted enough pain on her sister. I want to smoke now, Masuma says. Parwana begins to protest, but Masuma cuts her off. It's time, she says, harder now, with finality. From the bag slung around the saddle's tip, Parvana fetches the hookah. With trembling hands, she begins to prepare the usual mixture in the hookah's bowl. More, Masuma says. Put in a lot more. Sniffling, her cheeks wet, Parvana adds another pinch, then another, and yet more again. She lights the coal and places the hookah next to her sister. Now, Masuma says. The orange glow of the flame shimmering on her cheeks, in her eyes. If you ever love me, Parvana, if you were ever my true sister, then leave. No kisses, no goodbyes. Don't make me beg. Parvana begins to say something, but Masuma makes a pained, choking sound and rolls her head away. Parvana slowly rises to her feet. She walks to the mule and tightens the saddle. She grabs the reins to the animal. She suddenly realizes that she may not know how to live without Masuma. She doesn't know if she can. How will she bear the days when Masuma's absence feels like a far heavier burden than her presence ever had? How will she learn to tread around the edges of the big gaping hole where Masuma had once been? Have heart, she almost hears Masuma saying. Parvana pulls the reins, turns the mule around, and begins to walk. She walks, slicing the dark, as a cool night wind rips across her face. She keeps her head down. She turns around once only later. Through the moisture in her eyes, the campfire is a distant, dim, tiny blur of yellow. She pictures her twin sister lying by the fire, alone in the dark. Soon the fire will die and Masuma will be cold. Her instinct is to go back, to cover her sister with a blanket and slip in next to her. Parvana makes herself wheel around and resume walking once more. And that is when she hears something. A faraway muffled sound. Like wailing. Parvana stops in her tracks. She tilts her head and hears it again. Her heart begins to ram in her chest. She wonders with dread if it's Masuma calling her back, having had a change of heart. Or maybe it is nothing but a jackal or a desert fox howling somewhere in the dark. Parvana can't be sure. She thinks it might be the wind. Don't leave me, sister. Come back. The only way to know for sure is to go back the way she had come, and Parvana begins to do just that. She turns around and takes a few steps in Masuma's direction. Then she stops. Masuma was right. If she goes back now, she will not have the courage to do it when the sun rises. She will lose heart and end up staying. She will stay forever. This is her only chance. Parvana shuts her eyes. The wind makes the scarf flap against her face. No one has to know. No one would. It would be her secret. One she would share with the mountains only. The question is whether it is a secret she can live with. And Parvana thinks she knows the answer. She has lived with secrets all her life. She hears the wailing again in the distance. Everyone loved you, Masuma. No one me. And why, sister? What had I done? Parvana stands motionless in the dark for a long time. At last, she makes her choice. She turns around, drops her head, and walks toward a horizon she cannot see. After that, she does not look back anymore. She knows that if she does, she will weaken. She will lose what resolve she has because she will see an old bicycle speeding down a hill, bouncing on rocks and gravel, the metal pounding both their rears. Clouds of dust kicked up with each sudden skid. She sits on the frame, and Masuma is the one on the saddle. She is the one who takes the hairpin turns at full speed, dropping the bike into the deep lean. But Parvana is not afraid. She knows that her sister will not send her flying over the handlebars, that she will not hurt her. The world melts into a whirligig blare of excitement, and the wind whooshes in their ears. And Parvana looks over her shoulder at her sister, and her sister looks back. And they laugh together as stray dogs give chase. Parvana keeps marching toward her new life. She keeps walking, the darkness around her like a mother's womb. And when it lifts, when she looks up in the dawn haze and catches a band of pale light from the east striking the side of a boulder, it feels like being born.
Chapter 4. In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. I know that I will be gone when you read this letter, Mr. Marcos. For when I gave it to you, I requested that you not open it until after my death. Let me state now what a pleasure it has been to know you over the last 7 years, Mr. Marcos. As I write this, I think fondly of our yearly ritual of planting tomatoes in the garden, your morning visits to my small quarters for tea and pleasantry, our impromptu trading of Farsi and English lessons. I thank you for your friendship, your thoughtfulness, and for the work that you have undertaken in this country. And I trust that you will extend my gratitude to your kind-hearted colleagues as well, especially to my friend Miss Amra Adimovich, who has such capacity for compassion, and to her brave and lovely daughter, Rushi. I should say that I intend this letter not just for you, Mr. Marcos, but for another as well, to whom I hope you will pass it on, as I shall explain later. Forgive me, then, if I repeat a few things you may already know. I include them out of necessity, for her benefit. As you will see, this letter contains more than an element of confession, Mr. Marcos, but there are also pragmatic matters that prompt this writing. For those, I fear I will call upon your assistance, my friend. I have thought long on where to begin this story. No easy task, this, for a man who must be in his mid-80s. My exact age is a mystery to me, as it is to many Afghans of my generation. But I am confident in my approximation, because I recall quite vividly a fistfight with my friend, and later to be brother-in-law, Sabur, on the day we heard that Nader Shah had been shot and killed, and that Nader Shah's son, young Zahir, had ascended to the throne. That was 1933. I could begin there, I suppose, or somewhere else. The story is like a moving train. No matter where you hop on board, you're bound to reach your destination sooner or later. But I suppose I ought to begin this tale with the same thing that ends it. Yes, I think it stands to reason that I bookend this account with Nila Wathati. I met her in 1949, the year she married Mr. Wathati. At the time, I had already been working for Mr. Sulaiman Wathati for 2 years, having moved to Kabul from Shadbagh, the village where I was born, back in 1946. I had worked for a year in another household in the same neighborhood. The circumstances of my departure from Shadbagh are not something I am proud of, Mr. Marcos. Consider it the first of my confessions, then, when I say that I felt stifled by the life I had in the village with my sisters, one of whom was an invalid. Not that it absolves me, but I was a young man, Mr. Marcos, eager to take on the world, full of dreams, modest and vague as they may have been, and I pictured my youth ebbing away, my prospects increasingly truncated. So I left. To help provide for my sisters, yes, that is true, but also to escape. Since I was a full-time worker for Mr. Wathati, I lived at his residence full-time as well. In those days, the house bore little resemblance to the lamentable state in which you found it when you arrived in Kabul in 2002, Mr. Marcos. It was a beautiful, glorious place. The house shone sparkling white in those days, as if sheathed with diamonds. The front gates opened onto a wide asphalt driveway. One entered into a high-ceiling foyer decorated with tall ceramic vases and a circular mirror framed in carved walnut, precisely the spot where you for a while hung the old homemade camera photo of your childhood friend at the beach. The marble floor of the living room glistened and was partly covered by a dark red Turkoman carpet. The carpet is gone now, as are the leather sofas, the handcrafted coffee table, the lapis chess set, the tall mahogany cabinet. Little of the grand furniture has survived, and I'm afraid that it is not in the shape it once was. The first time I entered the stone-tiled kitchen, my mouth fell wide open. I thought it had been built large enough to feed all of my home village of Shadbagh. I had a 6-burner stove, a refrigerator, a toaster, and an abundance of pots, pans, knives, and appliances at my disposal. The bathrooms, all 4 of them, had intricately carved marble tiles and porcelain sinks. And there's square holes in your bathroom counter upstairs, Mr. Marcos? They were once filled with lapis. Then there was the backyard. You must one day sit in your office upstairs, Mr. Marcos, look down on the garden, try to picture it as it was. One entered it through a semilunar veranda bordered by a railing sheathed with green vines. The lawn in those days was lush and green and dotted with beds of flowers, jasmine, sweetbriar, geranium, tulips, and bordered by 2 rows of fruit trees. A man could lie beneath one of those cherry trees, Mr. Marcos, close his eyes, and listen to the breeze squeezing through the leaves, and think that there wasn't on earth a finer place to live. My own living space was a shack in the back of the yard. It had a window, clean walls with white paint, and provided enough space to accommodate an unmarried young man his meager needs. I had a bed, a desk and a chair, and enough room to unroll my prayer rug 5 times a day. It suited me just fine then, and it suits me fine now. I cooked for Mr. Wathati, a skill I had picked up first from observing my late mother, and later from an elderly Uzbek cook who worked at a household in Kabul, where I had served for a year as his help. I was also, and quite happily, Mr. Wathati's chauffeur. He owned a mid-1940s model Chevrolet, blue with a tan top, matching blue vinyl seats and chrome wheels, a handsome car that drew lingering looks wherever we went. He allowed me to drive because I had proven myself to be a prudent and skilled driver. And besides, he was a rare breed of man who did not enjoy the act of operating a car. Please do not think I am boasting, Mr. Marcos, when I say I was a good servant. Through careful observation, I had familiarized myself with Mr. Wathati's likes and dislikes, his quirks, his peeves. I had come to know his habits and rituals well. For instance, every morning after breakfast, he liked to go for a stroll. He disliked walking alone, however, and thus I was expected to accompany him. I abided by this wish, of course, though I did not see the point of my presence. He hardly said a word to me in the course of these walks, and seemed forever lost in his own thoughts. He walked briskly, hands clamped behind his back, nodding at passers-by, the heels of his well-polished leather loafers clicking against the pavement. And because his long legs made strides I could not match, I was always falling behind and forced to catch up. The rest of the day, he mostly retreated to his study upstairs, reading or playing a game of chess against himself. He loved to draw, though I could not attest to his skills, at least not then, because he never shared his artwork with me. And I would often catch him up in the study, by the window, or on the veranda, his brow furrowed in concentration, his charcoal pencil looping and circling over the sketch pad. I drove him around the city every few days. He went to see his mother once a week. There were also family gatherings. And though Mr. Wahdati avoided most of them, he did attend on occasion, and so I would drive him there, to funerals, birthday parties, weddings. I drove him monthly to an art supply store, where he restocked his pastel pencils, his charcoal, and his erasers and sharpeners and sketchbooks. Sometimes, he liked to sit in the back seat and just go for a drive. I would say, "Where to, Sahib?" And he would shrug, and I would say, "Very well, Sahib." And would shift into gear, and off we would go. I would drive us around the city for hours, without aim or purpose, from one neighborhood to another, alongside the Kabul River, up to Bala Hisar, sometimes out to the Darul Aman Palace. Some days, I drove us out of Kabul and up to Gharqa Lake, where I would park the car near the banks of the water. I would turn off the engine, and Mr. Wahdati would sit perfectly still in the back seat, not saying a word to me, seemingly content enough to just roll down the window and look at the birds darting from tree to tree, and the streaks of sunlight that struck the lake and scattered into 1,000 tiny bobbing specks on the water. I would gaze at him in the rearview mirror, and he looked to me like the most lonesome person on earth. Once a month, Mr. Wahdati, quite generously, let me borrow his car, and I would drive to Shadbagh, my native village, to visit my sister Parwana and her husband Sabur. Whenever I drove into the village, I would be greeted by hordes of hollering children who would scamper alongside the car, slapping the fender, tapping at the window. Some of the little runts would even try to climb atop the roof, and I would have to shoo them away for fear that they would scratch the paint or cause a dent in the fender. "Look at you, Nabi," Sabur said to me. "You are a celebrity." Because his children, Abdullah and Pari, had lost their natural mother, Parwana was their stepmother, I always tried to be attentive to them, especially to the older boy, who most seemed to need it. I offered to take him alone for rides in the car, though he always insisted on bringing his baby sister, holding her tightly in his lap, as we circled the road around Shadbagh. I let him work the wipers, honk the horn. I showed him how to switch the headlights from dim to full. After all the fuss about the car died down, I would sit for tea with my sister and Sabur, and I would tell them about my life in Kabul. I took care not to say too much about Mr. Wahdati. I was, in truth, quite fond of him, for he treated me well, and speaking of him behind his back seemed to me like a betrayal. If I had been a less discreet employee, I would have told them that Sulaiman Wahdati was a mystifying creature to me, a man seemingly satisfied with living the rest of his days off the wealth of his inheritance, a man with no profession, no apparent passion, and apparently no impulse to leave behind something of himself in this world. I would have told him that he lived a life lacking in purpose or direction, like those aimless rides I took him on. A life lived from the back seat, observed as it blurred by. An indifferent life. This is what I would have said, but I did not. And a good thing I did not, for how wrong I would have been. One day, Mr. Wahdati came into the yard wearing a handsome pinstriped suit, one I had never seen on him before, and requested that I drive him to an affluent neighborhood of the city. When we arrived, He instructed me to park on the street outside a beautiful high-walled house, and I watched him ring the bell at the gates and enter when a servant answered. The house was huge, bigger than Mr. Wahdati's, and even more beautiful. Tall, slender cypresses adorned the driveway, along with a densely packed array of bushes of a flower I did not recognize. The backyard was at least twice the size of Mr. Wahdati's, and the walls stood tall enough that if a man climbed on the shoulders of another, he still could hardly steal a peek. This was wealth of another magnitude, I recognized. It was a bright early summer day, and the sky was brilliant with sunshine. Warm air wafted in through the windows, which I had rolled down. Though chauffeur's job is to drive, he actually spends most of his time waiting. Waiting outside stores, engine idling, waiting outside a wedding hall, listening to the muffled sound of the music. To pass the time that day, I played a few games of cards. When I tired of cards, I stepped out of the car and took a few steps in one direction, then the other. I sat inside once more, thinking I might steal a nap before Mr. Wahdati returned. It was then that the front gates opened and a black-haired young woman emerged. She wore sunglasses and a short-sleeved tangerine-colored dress that fell short of the knees. Her legs were bare, and so were her feet. I did not know whether she had noticed me sitting in the car, and if she had, she offered no indication. She rested the heel of one foot against the wall behind her, and when she did, the hem of the dress pulled up slightly and thus revealed a bit of the thigh beneath. I felt a burning spread down from my cheeks to my neck. "Allow me to make another confession here, Mr. Marcos, one of a somewhat distasteful nature, leaving little room for elegant handling. At the time, I must have been in my late 20s, a young man at the prime of his desires for a woman's company. Unlike many of the men I grew up with in my village, young men who had never seen the bare thigh of a grown woman and married, in part, for the license to at last cast their gaze upon such a sight, I did have some experience. I had found in Kabul, and on occasion visited, establishments where a young man's needs could be addressed with both discretion and convenience. I mention this only to make the point that no whore I had ever lain with could compare with the beautiful, graceful creature who had just stepped out of the big house. Leaning against the wall, she lit a cigarette and smoked without hurry and with bewitching grace, holding it at the very tip of two fingers and cupping her hand before her mouth each time she raised it to her lips. I watched with rapt attention. The way her hand bent at its slender wrist reminded me of an illustration I had once seen in a glossy book of poems of a long-lashed woman with flowing dark hair lying with her lover in a garden, offering him a cup of wine with her pale, delicate fingers. At one point, something seemed to catch the woman's attention up the street in the opposite direction, and I used the brief chance to quickly finger-brush my hair, which was beginning to mat down in the heat. When she turned back, I froze once more. She took a few more puffs, crushed the cigarette against the wall, and sauntered back inside. At last, I could breathe. That night, Mr. Wahdati called me into the living room and said, "I have news, Nebi. I'm getting married." It seemed I had overestimated his fondness for solitude after all. News of the engagement spread swiftly, and so did rumors. I heard them from the other workers who came and went through Mr. Wahdati's house. The most vocal of these was Zahid, a gardener who came in 3 days a week to maintain the lawn and trim the trees and bushes, an unpleasant fellow with a repulsive habit of flicking his tongue after each sentence, a tongue with which he cast rumors as offhandedly as he tossed fistfuls of fertilizer. He was part of a group of lifelong laborers who, like me, worked in the neighborhood as cooks, gardeners, and errand men. One or two nights a week, after the workday was over, they squeezed into my shack for after-dinner tea. I do not recall how this ritual started, but once it did, I was powerless to stop it, wary of seeming rude and inhospitable, or worse, of appearing to think myself superior to my own kind. Over tea one night, Zahir told the other men that Mr. Wahdati's family did not approve of the marriage because of his bride-to-be's poor character. He said it was well known in Kabul that she had no nang and no moose, no honor, and though she was only 20, she had already been ridden all over town like Mr. Wahdati's car. Worst of all, he said, not only had she made no attempt to deny these allegations, she wrote poems about them. A murmur of disapproval spread through the room when he said this. One of the men remarked that in his village, they would have slit her throat by now. That was when I rose and told them that I had heard enough. I berated them for gossiping like a sewing circle of old women, and reminded them that without people like Mr. Wahdati, the likes of us would be back in our villages collecting cow dung. Where is your loyalty, your respect? I demanded. A brief moment of quiet passed, during which I thought I had made an impression on the dullards, and then laughter broke out. Zahid said I was an ass-licker, and perhaps the soon-to-be mistress of the house would ink a poem and call it Ode to Nabi, the Licker of Many Asses. I stomped indignantly out of the shack to an uproar of cackles. But I did not stray too far. Their gossip, by turns, revolted and fascinated me. And despite my show of righteousness, for all my talk of propriety and discretion, I stayed within earshot. I did not want to miss a single lurid detail. The engagement lasted only days and culminated not in a big ceremony with life singers and dancers and merriment all around, but with a brief visit by a mullah, a witness, and the scribbling of two signatures across a sheet of paper. And with that, less than 2 weeks after I had laid eyes on her for the first time, Mrs. Wahdati moved into the house. Allow me a brief pause here, Mr. Marcos, to say that I will from here on refer to Mr. Wahdati's wife as Nila. Needless to say, this is a liberty I was not allowed back then, and one I would not have accepted even if it had been offered to me. I refer to her always as Bibi Sahib, with the deference expected of me. But for the purposes of this letter, I will dispense with etiquette and refer to her the way I always thought of her. Now, I knew from the start that the marriage was an unhappy one. Rarely did I see a tender look pass between the couple or hear an affectionate word uttered. There were two people occupying the same house whose paths rarely seemed to intersect at all. In the mornings, I served Mr. Wahdati his customary breakfast, a piece of toasted naan, half a cup of walnuts, green tea with a sprinkle of cardamom and no sugar, and a single boiled egg. He liked the yolk to run just so when he punctured the egg, and my initial failures to master this particular consistency had proved a source of considerable anxiety on my part. While I accompanied Mr. Wahdati on his daily morning walk, Nila slept in, often until noon or even later. By the time she rose, I was all but ready to serve Mr. Wahdati his lunch. All morning, as I tended to my chores, I ached for the moment when Nila would push the screen door that opened from the living room out into the veranda. I would play games in my head, guessing at her appearance that particular day. Would her hair be up, I wondered, tied in a bun at the back of her neck, or would I see it loose, tumbling down over her shoulders? Would she wear sunglasses? Would she opt for sandals? Would she choose the blue silk robe with the belt or the magenta one with the big round buttons? When she made her entrance at last, I would busy myself in the yard, pretending the hood of the car needed wiping, or else I would find a sweetbriar bush to water. But the whole time I watched. I watched when she pushed up her sunglasses to rub her eyes, or when she removed the elastic band from her hair and threw back her head to let the dark, lustrous curls fall loose. And I watched when she sat with her chin resting on her knees, staring into the yard, taking languid drags of her cigarette, or when she crossed her legs and bobbed one foot up and down, a gesture that suggested to me boredom or restlessness, or perhaps heedless mischief barely held in check. Mr. Wahdati was, on occasion, at her side, but often not. He spent most of his days as he had before, reading in the upstairs study, doing his sketches, his daily routines more or less unaltered by the fact of marriage. Neela wrote most days, either in the living room or else on the veranda, pencil in hand, sheets of paper spilling from her lap, and always the cigarettes. At night, I served them dinner, and they each received the meal in pointed silence, gaze lower to the platter of rice, the quiet broken only by a muttered thank you, and the tinkling of spoon and fork against china. Once or twice a week, I had to drive Neela when she needed a pack of cigarettes or a fresh set of pens, a new notepad, makeup. If I knew ahead of time that I would be driving her, I always made sure to comb my hair and brush my teeth. I washed my face, rubbed the sliced lemon against my fingers to rid them of the scent of onions, patted the dust off my suit, and polished my shoes. The suit, which was olive-colored, was in fact a hand-me-down from Mr. Wahdati, and I hoped he hadn't told this to Neela, though I suspected he may have. Not out of malice, but because people in Mr. Wahdati's position often cannot appreciate how small, trivial things like this could bring shame to a man like me. Sometimes, I even wore the lambskin cap that had belonged to my late father. I would stand there before the mirror, tilting the cap this way and that on my head, so absorbed in the act of rendering myself presentable to Neela that if a wasp had landed on my nose, it would have had to sting me to make its presence known. Once we were on the road, I looked for minor detours to our destination, if possible. Detours designed to prolong the trip by a minute, or maybe two, but no more, lest she grow suspicious, and thereby extend my time with her. I drove with both hands clenching the wheel and my eyes firmly on the road. I exercised rigid self-control and did not look at her in the rearview mirror, doing so only if she addressed me. I contented myself with the mere fact of her presence in the back seat, with breathing in her many scents, expensive soap, lotion, perfume, chewing gum, cigarette smoke. That, most days, was sufficient to lend wings to my spirits. It was in the car that we had our first conversation. Our first real conversation, that is, discounting myriad times she had asked me to fetch this or carry that. I was taking her to a pharmacy to pick up medicine when she said, "What is it like, Nabi? Your village. What is it called again?" "Chaudbourg, Bibi Sahib." "Chaudbourg, yes. What is it like? Tell me." "Well, there isn't much to say, Bibi Sahib. It is a village like any other." "Oh, surely, there's some distinguishing thing." I stayed calm in my appearance, but I was frantic inside, desperate to retrieve something, some clever oddity that might be of interest to her, that might amuse her. It was no use. What could a man like me, a villager, a small man with a small life, possibly have to say that would capture the fancy of a woman like her? "The grapes are excellent," I said. And no sooner had I uttered the words than I wished to slap my own face. "Grapes?" "Are they?" she said flatly. "Oh, very sweet indeed." Ah, I was dying a thousand deaths inside. I felt moisture beginning to form under my arms. "There is one particular grape," I said from a suddenly dry mouth. "They say it grows only in Chaudbourg. It's very brittle, you see, very fragile. If you try to grow it in any other place, even the next village over, it will wither and die. It will perish. It dies of sadness, people in Chaudbourg say. But of course, that's not true. It's a matter of soil and water. But that's what they say, Bibi Sahib. Sadness." "That's really lovely, Nabi." I chanced a quick glance at the rearview mirror and saw that she was looking out her window. But I also found, to my great relief, the corners of her mouth curled up just so, in a shadow of a smile. Heartened now, I heard myself say, "May I tell you another story, Bibi Sahib?" "By all means." The lighter clicked, and smoke drifted toward me from the back seat. "Well, we have a mullah in Chaudbourg. All villages have a mullah, of course. Ours is named Mullah Shakib, and he's full of stories. How many he knows, I could not tell you. But one thing he always told us was this, that if you look at any Muslim's palms, no matter where in the world, you will see something quite astonishing, they all have the same lines. Meaning what? Meaning that the lines on a Muslim's left hand make the Arabic number 81, and the ones on the right, the number 18. Subtract